we were faced with a situation where over 1 million barrels of oil was sitting in a super tanker that was decaying and risked falling apart at any point, spilling all of that oil into the Red Sea. There was not much we knew about the tanker because it was actually difficult to get to. It was stuck in the middle of the Yemen civil war. So getting all of the parties to agree to how to manage access was not very easy to achieve. And then technically, of course, you wanted to do this one very well so as not to provoke a spill, but to prevent it. So we needed to get really good expertise in to do it. So we got one of the top salvage companies in the world to work on this. And then we needed something to put it in once we took it off. So we needed to procure another super tanker, which we purchased in March of this year, to hold the oil that was transferred off. But that took about, oh, I'd say 18 months of political work to get the agreement of the parties, technical planning, fundraising. Raising $140 million is not an easy thing to do. And so trying to get everybody to contribute that amount of money took many, many months, in fact. So it was a political challenge, a security challenge, a technical challenge, and a funding challenge that we had to overcome in order to get to this point. But fortunately, all those pieces did come together earlier this year. I got good expertise brought on board by UNDP on legal, maritime issues, maritime procurement. It was very important to get that in place so that we could actually tackle this problem correctly.
Can we now say that the threat is finally over?
We can say that the immediate threat is over. Of course, it's now in a second vessel. It's a much newer vessel, and it's not decaying, and it has modern environmental protection safeguards built in. It's double hulled, so it's not going to present a threat for a long time to come. But we do need to find a way to keep it maintained, to keep it perfectly safe. That's an issue that we're working on now, is sort of the post-operation management of it.
And that was my question. Who's going to take care of the new vessel?
Technically, the Yemeni authorities, but we promised both parties that we would sit down with them on the conclusion of the transfer project to look at a way to find, you know, funding and a modality to keep the vessel properly maintained. So we're at that stage now. We'll start working on that.
Have you reached an agreement regarding the sale of the oil? And is it usable?
The oil looks to be quite good. The seals were largely intact. It's lightweight crude, so it should be worth pretty good amount, actually. So the oil can be sold, which is good, because there'll be a motivation to sell it. But that, too, will need to be negotiated between the parties, because those who control the oil are not those who own the oil. And so we have to find a way to make that acceptable to all parties.
Mr. Grizzly, now that everything is about to go back to normal and Safar is no longer a threat, what's the future of the replacement vessel, the Yemen? How long is going to be there? And are there any guarantees to prevent a situation similar to Safar?
I think it's important to remember that the original Safar has been there since 1988. It's an offshore storage vessel whose purpose is to store oil offshore, basically coming out of the Safar oil fields and then piped into the FSO Safar for storage until it could be sold. It's just that when the war began, there was a million barrels of oil inside the Safar waiting to be sold, but never could be sold. So there's no problem storing oil offshore. It's done all over the world. There's hundreds of such storage vessels, in fact, throughout the world. So in itself, that's not a problem. The main thing is to ensure that it's reasonably well maintained until a political settlement is reached more broadly or a more local solution for the sale of the oil is reached. But we don't have time for either of those things to happen.
The oil spill from Safar tanker would have been the fifth largest oil spill from a tanker in history, with a devastating environmental impact on the waters and the people of Yemen and beyond. Can you tell us about the reactions of the Yemeni people? Are they happy, appreciative? What do they say to you?
Well, I think mainly it's two or three things. One, very happy that the threat is gone. Now, this is something that the people of Yemen have been worried about, regardless of which side of the front line they're on, regardless of their affiliation with any of the parties in conflict. They all know that this is a real threat to the Yemeni people. So there's relief that it's finally done. I think secondly, there's hope that the sale of the oil, if it were to take place, could be of benefit to the people of Yemen as well. They see hope there as well. And then thirdly, of course, it creates a bit of momentum and anticipation for acceleration of the peace process itself, and it creates more hope for that as well. So the news, the social media that we pick up, generally been very positive, and people are quite happy that finally something has been done about this particular issue.
Have you encountered any issues during this process?
Only from day one. It was a very hard process because these are parties in conflict and the level of trust is extraordinarily low. There was a high level of skepticism that this plan would ever work. Skepticism not only of the parties, but the potential donors. The question of what we're going to achieve with this was always in question. But I think today everybody sees that, in fact, it is possible, was possible, and we did it. And I think everybody's just celebrating right now, despite all the hard, hard days that we had to go through to raise the funding and get the all the approvals required from both parties, who often had contradictory demands on us. We had to navigate those contradictory demands in order to achieve the ability to get in and get the job done.
Congratulations again to you and to your team for this amazing work. In your view, what are the lessons learned from this entire process?
Several, actually. One, the UN can do hard things, and hard things are hard. That sounds very trite, but, when you take risks, that means there's challenges that are going to be hard to overcome. And I think it was very useful for all of us working on this to understand that with determination and a positive outlook, you can find solutions to very complex problems. But often, and what we had to do here was break everything down into smaller steps. And each step built upon the previous one, built upon the confidence and the trust to the point when it was time to do the actual transfer, we had a pretty high level of trust that this could be done correctly. So sometimes you can't plan everything out all in advance, which typically in the UN we like to do. Sometimes you have to take it in stages and work the problem through step by step. But there are many other lessons as well of how to work in this kind of a complex environment. It tested our procurement systems. It tested our financial management systems. It tested everybody's nerves as well. You need to keep your nerves intact to do something of this nature. But the rewards can be great. So I hope it creates an atmosphere of acceptance of risk where the UN can make such contributions and such risks are taken in the future. Managed risk, intelligent risk, but risk none the same.